Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the pain, profit, and politics of AIDS. My guest in this segment from London, United Kingdom, is Neville Hodgkinson. Neville is a British journalist who started reporting on the AIDS epidemic in the mid-1980s, who was very instrumental in looking at the medical and scientific evidence behind this. He also was the medical and science correspondent for the London Sunday Times, as well as the Sunday Express and the Daily Mail. His many investigations and subsequent articles questioned the mainstream views about HIV and AIDS, including the reporting from Africa and Australia and Europe. His book, Will to Be Well, The Real Alternative Medicine, was one of the first to describe wellness and happiness based upon scientific findings. In 1996, he published a scientific critique of the HIV theory in AIDS, The Failure of Contemporary Science, and continued to write articles for publications such as Continuum, New African, Journal of Scientific Exploration, and Business Online. Neville was connected with the creation of the AIDS Advisory Panel of South African President Mbeki. Nice to have you with us today, Neville.
Hello, Gary. It's great to hear you working on this extraordinary, tragic story again.
The reason I decided to do this story is because recently, while speaking with a group at a lecture on issues that I believe the public has been misled on, and the issue was really about the safety and efficacy of vaccines, of which I've written over 36 articles, all completely scientifically referenced. I've produced 3 multi-award-winning documentaries. I've interviewed the leading voices in toxicology and immunology. And I ask, where is the actual scientific evidence, the double-blind placebo-controlled studies? There were none. And the evidence that was there, these individuals who had no vested interest, they weren't pro or anti-vaccine, when they examined the studies, they found them flawed in the extreme. And then I asked basic questions. And so I then asked the audience, did they know any of this? And they did not. Then I said, what do you know about the subject of AIDS? And pretty much all of them knew the official story, that HIV is a single retrovirus which is able to cause 30-plus different specific conditions that end up destroying the immune system, that once you have it, you're going to die. It's just a matter of when. That there's a test that you can take that will determine if you have it, and then you have to go on antiretroviral drugs, and that is the only treatment. And anyone else who says anything else is an AIDS denialist. And when I said, well, how do you know that what you're telling me is true? What have you done to deconstruct your own reason and argument? And the answer was nothing. So up to this point, for nearly 30 years, there's really only been one voice speaking on AIDS. That's the official sanctioned voice through the National Institutes of Infection and Allergies, the National Cancer Institute, the U.S. Public Health Service, and various agencies similar to that around the world, with a group of scientists that originally was relatively small, but now numbers into the hundreds of thousands, with more than, at one point, its highest point, 75,000 foundations. Now, I don't know how many. I haven't looked recently, but it's far less. But this year, they're spending over $30 billion in the United States on AIDS. They've tried over 60 different vaccines. All of those have failed. And yet, they're still the only ones allowed to discuss AIDS. And any offering to debate the subject in open and legitimate forms is just rejected out of hand. So the very people who told us what this AIDS story was are the ones who are still controlling it today. There's a group of AIDS organizations within the gay community. There has been gay-on-gay attacks, including people's lives threatened if they wanted to expose the dangers of AZT way back in 1984, John Lawrenson, and Celia Farber, who had her reputation attacked, though she's an outstanding independent journalist. And so any scientist that has challenged this, no matter what their background, a professor of of virology, a professor of immunology, multiple Nobel Prize winners, more than 2,000 to 3,000 journalists, activists, physicians, and scientists, all examining the actual evidence and finding flaws or limitations with it. When they bring these up for discussion, are immediately shut up, shut down, and then attacked. That's why we're doing it. So that said, how did you confirm your investigations were correct, and how do you feel since it went against the accepted view of AIDS, and explain what you found that brought you to a decision that, hey, there's something wrong here with the official version? Take us in detail through that, please.
Okay. I'm a little bit ashamed in a sense that initially I reported AIDS absolutely conventionally for several years as a huge public health disaster. But after 3 or 4 years, it became apparent that predictions that had been made that it was going to spread to affect everybody and that we'd have a million or more people testing HIV positive and soon to die of AIDS in the early 1990s, that those predictions simply weren't coming about. AIDS was remaining confined to the original risk groups, who were people with some exceptional risks in their lives. The central thread of it was that they were being exposed to other people's body proteins on a regular basis. That included people receiving repeated transfusions, such as haemophiliacs at that time, people with that blood clotting disorder, haemophilia, promiscuous gay men, not gay men in general, but those who were at that time in the fight to win liberation in public attitudes towards homosexuality. Every bout of the clap was seen as a kind of victory for gay lib, and many, many, many of those pioneers of the gay liberation movement suffered repeated illnesses, were taking antibiotics on a continuous prophylactic basis, and were being exposed to semen and blood and drugs in ways that were clearly, in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, a threat to their health. And the third group was when the HIV tests, so-called, were exported to Africa, it was found that, you know, up to 50% of people in some parts of Africa were testing positive. So the whole theory was put together that it came from Africa, that it had been spreading there for longer, that half the population in Africa was at risk of early death because of it. And I bought into that, and I wrote along those lines for several years for the Sunday Times. In my first stretch with that very distinguished paper, I was writing for them as their medical correspondent. Then I left that job for a couple of years to work as a health editor on another paper, and I was a bit less hands-on. I was doing more general health reporting and editing. And then I returned to the Sunday Times, which I'd always loved, and I found that those predictions that I'd been reporting on were not coming about. And that started to worry me, because I didn't like to think that I was reporting rubbish. And I was helped by a documentary filmmaker, Joan Shenton, who was the first to highlight in the UK challenges to the theory that a newly identified virus was the cause of AIDS. And she had produced a documentary, of which I'd been dismissive at first, called AIDS, The Forgotten Voices, mainly voices from very distinguished biochemists and molecular biologists in the States. And it was pretty well regarded as a documentary, but also pretty widely ignored. And I went back to Joan Shenton when these doubts started to come, because those predictions weren't coming about. And she told me that I'd been wrong to be dismissive, and here was some of the science that showed why. And I had a little break from the intense day-by-day work that newspaper journalists are normally involved in, because we had a general election along at the time. and my work was less in demand. And so over a period of 5 or 6 weeks, I went right into some of these questions that that documentary had raised. I found that it was a very good case to question the HIV theory. And we published a huge 2-page spread in the Sunday Times that set out this these questions, simply called it AIDS, Are We Positive? And it produced a hysterical response. And it was this that over the years has been a repeated pattern that gradually led me more than the science almost, because you can never be sure when you've got sort of like the whole world against you, you can't really be sure that you're right, because, you know, it may be that you're, even though you know in your heart that you're doing what you think is the right thing, but humans are very vulnerable to getting things wrong, and you might be the one who is wrong and the rest of the world is right on this. So I always had that question, and it was uncomfortable. But what made me feel confident that I had to keep reporting these things was the hysterical and suppressive response that came from people involved in AIDS, including my fellow journalists, I have to say, in many instances, who were outraged that the HIV theory was being questioned by a leading paper like the Sunday Times. And I've seen that again and again over the decades that have followed, where people like Celia, who you mentioned, she'd produced a magnificent article, a 15-page report in Harper's Magazine in 2006, headed Out of Control, AIDS and the Corruption of Medical Science. I thought that at last that would mean the start of a debate about the true causes of AIDS, but it was her article was greeted mainly with incomprehension, and she was roundly criticized by the Columbia Journalism Review, who ought to be sticking up for journalistic standards, and instead they criticized her for airing crackpot ideas. So once again, an opportunity to end what I see as a real ongoing tragedy of faulty diagnosis and commonly misplaced treatment was lost. It's a real tragedy. I don't see any villains in this, to tell you the truth, Gary. I have not yet met someone who I think has consciously sat down and thought, let's deceive the public because we can make a lot of money out of this. Instead, I see people mainly well-intentioned, but who have got caught up in a kind of war against what was believed to be a deadly virus. And somehow the war atmosphere, you know, such as if a country is fighting a war, then it's hard for journalists to report independently. Of course, they would want to support their side in that war. And rather similar thing happened with HIV/AIDS, where it came to be seen there was so much fear was instituted by the initial misinterpretation, as I see it, of what was going on. So much fear created globally about this deadly new virus that the world's media, as well as many commercial and other interests, got behind the story and have subsequently found it so difficult to step back, because it's like so much egg on face, whether for the politicians who were behind these stories, the people who've made a lot of money and who's received a lot of grants out of it, or the media themselves, or the doctors and scientists who truly believe they were doing the right thing in highlighting these dangers, but who actually, I'm now convinced, had it wrong.
Let us then go through what you, as a medical and scientific journalist at one of the most respected publications in the world, found, and just lay out your case step by step.
One of the first things was that the predicted deaths were not happening. We were forecasting back in the 80s that there were reports of more than 1 million HIV positive people by the 1990s. That never happened. Nothing like it happened. And in fact, today, the total number of deaths from AIDS, which I don't question the reality of AIDS, but I question the causation theory. The total number of deaths from AIDS itself in the UK, a nation of 70 million people, is something like 250 a year. That compares with these predictions that millions would be dying. So there's something wrong with that. Now, scientists and others have claimed that this is a victory for the drugs that were developed. But in fact, what one finds if you look closely at that story is that in the anxious rush to find a treatment against this syndrome that was causing so much fear, a drug called AZT, which was really lethal, was prescribed in high doses, caused thousands of deaths. And as that gradually became realized, the quantities of AZT were reduced to a minimum, and other cocktails of more effective drugs for treating actual immune system disorders were offered to people with those immune system disorders. And so there was a big fall off in the number of AIDS deaths that were actually being reported. And that was attributed to the introduction of these drugs. And the fact that today we have only 250 AIDS deaths in the UK per annum, whereas millions were being predicted back in the 80s. That's all put down to these drugs, which actually today's drug regimes do have value in supporting a compromised immune system, but they don't have the value that has been claimed for them, because the decline in AIDS deaths came about because of the slow realization that AZT was lethal in the doses that it was prescribed at in those early years. So many, many mistakes of this kind have come about. Now, but the absolutely central one was the claim that a test for HIV had been established, and was strangely a kind of quarrel over who had been first to find HIV and create an effective test between Paris and the US, between Bob Gallo in Washington and Luc Montagnier in Paris. A quarrel arose which obscured the fact that neither of them had actually ever isolated this purported new virus. So the test that was claimed to be based on an actual identified and isolated new virus was faulty from the start. What it actually demonstrates and is the presence at higher levels than average of antibodies to cell proteins in a disordered immune system, not to a deadly new virus from the African jungle. But the problem is that because many of the conditions, those original risk group conditions where there is still a danger of a threat to health from heavy exposure to other people's body proteins, and indeed in Africa from traditional illnesses associated with malnutrition, in those circumstances, people commonly will have those raised levels of antibodies, which are misinterpreted as meaning the evidence of a deadly virus, whereas in fact, the common factor in these various conditions is raised levels of cell death caused by the various conditions that produce that. So it was a mistake that got right in at the very beginning of all of this, and it happened primarily because there was never an identification of an actual virus. There was a misinterpretation of signals going on in the body that it was thought that they meant the presence of this virus, but that virus was never isolated and purified and analyzed so as to be able to validate the so-called HIV tests. They are unvalidated and invalid. I was amazed in the mid-90s, I first received a paper that had been published in Biotechnology, a sister paper to Nature, a very well-respected paper, very well-respected journal. And this paper demonstrated what I've just been saying, that the HIV test was unvalidated and probably invalid. And I sent it round a number. I could hardly believe it. I'd already been reporting some of the doubts about the severity of this epidemic, but I could hardly believe that the basic problem arose with the test itself. And so I sent it round a number of virologists, and I think I got replies from only one or two of them who were unable actually to make any sensible comment about this. They just said, our profession has accepted this as a valid test and we're using it. So when I tried to get anyone to refute or challenge or come back on these things, I failed to get that. So much with much trepidation, we went ahead, published a big story in the paper saying exactly this, that the HIV test was unvalidated. And I expected that there would be a scientific response to it, but there wasn't. It was completely ignored. It's quite amazing how that either there is an ignoring, or if you force the issue through sheer weight of evidence and exposure in the paper or in any medium, if you force the issue, then you get a comeback of abuse. And so, as you were saying earlier, you'll be accused of being a denialist, all these labels making you out to be like a Holocaust denier, when you're really trying to bring to light a tragedy that is still affecting millions of people across the world because of the misdiagnosis of this through this unvalidated so-called HIV test. It's such a tragedy. I went to Africa at one point after I'd done a number of stories gradually unfolding these problems for the Sunday Times. The editor said, "All right, Neville, it seems that it's nothing like we thought it was in the 80s. You've raised questions about the validity of the test. But what about Africa? We're being told that millions are infected there and dying." And so he sent me to Africa. I'd never been to that continent before. And I spent several weeks over there talking to doctors, scientists, patients, visiting hospitals, and it gradually emerged for me. It became clear that what had happened was that a huge panic had started because people had used this unvalidated test. They'd thought that millions were infected because of the false diagnoses of HIV positivity that were prevalent in that continent in poor people. People with, among the conditions that can produce this a positive result with the so-called HIV test is TB and that family, which is massively widespread in malnourished populations. Multiple childbirth can do it. There are many other conditions there that cause this, and none of that was being taken into account. And I tried to report on that, and it produced a hysterical reaction from the scientific establishment back here in the UK. Nature magazine, which is supposed to be one of the leading science journals in the world, the editor ran an editorial saying that they'd contemplated picketing our offices to try to stop Neville Hodgkinson from writing these articles and to stop the paper from publishing them. Instead of, you know, that's a science journal. Instead of actually answering these reports, they wanted to stop us through pickets. They said, the editor said, "We've decided that would be a bit impractical, so instead we're going to have a campaign of ridicule. Every article that he writes, we're going to just ridicule it." And they did that for a while, until eventually we had a change of editor, and the editor who had been there for 10 years and who'd been so supportive of this work that I'd done, who really knew the background on it, he left, and his successor didn't want me to continue with it because I think he just couldn't really believe that the scientific and medical establishments could have got it so wrong. So this is the story. It's a tragic story of human foibles.
Let me ask you one question concerning what you just said. I have done a lot of research on the antibody test, the gold standard to determine do you have the HIV antibody, because it does not measure the virus. I found that there's now at least 77 separate conditions: measles, the flu vaccine, pregnancy, tuberculosis, arthritis, malaria, and many other conditions that will give you a false positive reading, which means you don't have you don't have HIV, but you'll read as if you do. And back then, when a person got a single confirmatory test, rarely did they get any follow-up, and no one ever asked you, do you have any other conditions? And then in Africa, They were not even doing the test. They were looking for symptoms frequently. Did you lose 10% of your body weight? Did you have a non-productive dry cough? Did you have a fever? And if you said yes to these, it was considered you had HIV, and you were put immediately on antiretroviral chemicals, drugs, chemotherapy drugs. And if you were malnourished, if you suffered from schistosomiasis, a parasitic infection from bad water, or if you had a malaria or malnutrition, which is frequently in some areas of Africa, then people were not dying because of the diseases they normally would have. They were dying from the treatment, and no one seemed to pay attention to this. So would you address the two contradictions? A, there was never a gold standard for the test, isn't to this day, and therefore you could test positive in one area of the world and negative in another. And B, you could test positive, but then when you do an examination, they cannot ever find the virus in your blood, but they can find other conditions like hepatitis, herpes can get you a positive reading, and they weren't looking at these contradictions as if they had their mind made up. Now, don't bother us with any conflicting information. Could you address these two phenomena and how many people died in Africa who did not have HIV but who had other conditions, and especially in South Africa, because I did a report from South Africa where I showed the GWIS, all the wealthy people, the business community owners, the industrialists who were African, they had no HIV. Then the bureaucracy, the police officers, the professors, the accountants, the engineers, they had no HIV. Because they had clean water and they had good food, and then you go across the minefields and you go into the ghettos and you find people who didn't have netting for their windows. They had mosquito bites and malaria. They had malnutrition. They had polluted water. Oh, and they had the epidemic. So I ask a single question. How smart is a virus that it will not infect you if you're rich, if you're well-fed, if you have a clean and sanitary working environment, but it will infect you? It was so absurd, and I couldn't understand why no one would address these contradictions. Would you address these, please? Take your time.
Yes, Gary. The first thing is to emphasize that there is no, in my view, the position I've reached now on this after studying this for 25 years is that there is no false positive, because there is no positive. There is no HIV. HIV's existence is unproven. The reason that there was no gold standard to validate the HIV test is that HIV had never been isolated and purified. And you must have a virus isolated and purified to validate a diagnostic test. That was never done, and that was obscured. What the test tests for is a disorder of cells brought about by a huge variety of conditions, exactly as you've just stated, including substances and exposures and infections common to all the AIDS risk groups, rather than by a virus whose existence is unproven. And the group that has done most to demonstrate that is based 2,000 miles away from any other scientists in the world, in Perth, Western Australia. And I think it's almost like their isolation there, and they've got a very good website that your listeners can go to. It's www.theperthgroup.com. They have been pursuing the case for all these years, painstakingly building the case that we should see AIDS and all the phenomena interpreted as meaning the presence of HIV as a disorder of cells brought about by these common factors, rather than by a virus whose existence they regard as unproven. These are first-class researchers with very relevant expertise, but the mainstream scientific and medical communities have persistently marginalized them. They find it so difficult to get published, and yet they're doing first-class work. At some point, it's going to be understood that this whole edifice of so-called cross-reactions and so forth, or false reactions, it's not a question of some people having HIV and others not having a false positive. No one has HIV. there is no HIV. I'm now completely convinced of this fact. HIV is a construct, a mistake that came about in a climate of fear and worry and also political pressure when the Reagan administration had neglected gay men's plight with those early AIDS cases back in the 80s, early 80s. And then suddenly, when it became clear that this wasn't going to go away and the case was being presented that more than just some a subgroup of gay men were at risk, that other groups like the haemophiliacs and drug abusers, they were also at risk, drug users. These the pressure on the the Department of Health, your Department of Health, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, was so great that they were telling their scientists, come up with some explanation so that we can offer some treatment. And it was in that climate of opinion, of fear and worry and political pressure, that the early AIDS, HIV, the early AIDS scientists gave birth to this HIV theory. But, you know, there was a very interestingly, one of America's top molecular biologists, Peter Duesberg, was totally skeptical about these claims when they were first being made. And when it came out that he'd prepared a paper that was questioning it, although he doesn't go as far as the Perth group of scientists in dissing the entire concept of HIV, but when he was first questioning the theory that this virus was causing AIDS, very illuminatingly, a memo was sent from the Office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services headed Media Alert. And it went to the Surgeon General, the White House, the Chief of Staff. It said, this obviously has the potential to raise a lot of controversy. Brackets, if this isn't the virus, how do we know the blood supply is safe? How do we know anything about transmission? How could you all be so stupid? And why should we ever believe you again? And we need to be prepared to respond. And, you know, we had a similar response over here. In 1988, John Maddox, who was the editor of Nature, that influential science journal, he'd rejected numerous submissions from Professor Duesberg, but he wrote to him, I'm glad you correctly infer from my letter that I'm in many ways sympathetic to what you say. I did not ask you to revise the manuscript, however. He'd refused to publish a manuscript Duesberg had sent. The danger, as it seems to me, is that the dispute between you and what you call the HIV community will mislead and distress the public in the following way. You point to a number of ways in which the HIV hypothesis may be deficient. It would be a rash person who said that you were wrong, but if we were to publish your paper, we would find ourselves asking people to believe that what has been said so far about the cause of AIDS is a pack of lies. You see, these guys, the bandwagon had started rolling and they were embarrassed about stopping it. It's such a tragedy. They knew from the start that there was a problem, but it got swept under the carpet because people just didn't want to admit that they'd gone down the wrong track. And that's a very human thing to do, but it's a failure on the part of science that its checks and balances did not stop that from happening.
When I was in England last, and I filmed you, and I filmed Gordon Higgins and several others, Gordon Stewart, I should say, and Joan Shenton and Hugh Christie, I also was interviewing one of the leading two top leading men in the AIDS community, the medical community in London. And I wanted to give all sides to the issue. And I asked him, I said, how is it that when a person is vaccinated, the whole concept of a vaccine is to give a small attenuated amount of a given antigen, like chickenpox or measles or polio, to a person to stimulate an immune response, to create antibodies, and then the quality of those antibodies will then be the basis determining a person's response when they actually come into contact at some point in their life, possibly with that antigen, and then the body has an immune response and they're protected. And I said, but with AIDS, the mere fact that you have antibodies shows that you are infected and you will die. I said, that turns science upside down. And why... why haven't you actually found the virus? And he said, oh, we've got tons of virus. And I said, can you show it? Yeah. I said, can I film it? He said, yes. And at the end of the interview, when I said, can we go? And he said, well, not now. No matter how many times I reached out to go in his laboratory, I wanted to see the virus because no matter where I went, I could not find anyone willing to show me the actual virus. And then when I got hold...
You won't. Anywhere in the world. No. It's never been found.
And then when I... And then when I had some people in New York who were dying supposedly of massive viral load, Dr. Ho's notion of, you know, hit them hard, hit them heavy, and to reduce the viral load, I simply ask, show me the actual viral load. I want to see an elevated viral load. I want to see all this massive amount. You're saying there's a massive amount of HIV. Fine. I'll accept that. I simply want to see it and film it. And then I was told, well, read Gallo's original article in Science Magazine. There's a picture of it. But then, lo and behold, there was a journalist, an outstanding journalist. I just found she passed recently, Janine Roberts, a 40-year journalist who wrote what has to be one of the most brilliant books on vaccines and on AIDS. And she managed to spend months in Washington, and she got access to some meetings with scientists. And there she found a letter, and the letter was from the Dr. Gallo's lab director. And Gallo had gone on vacation or gone to Europe, I think, to get people interested in his antibody test. And the man wrote the final article that was to go in Nature magazine, Science magazine, and there he didn't find that they had a unique, exclusive, one-of-a-kind retrovirus that was causing disease. And he says so right there. And also what was very revealing was the director of the electron microscope division of the National Cancer Institute sent back a letter showing that there is no unique viral material here. This is debris. And then yet that's not what came out in the article. Then Janine got, when Gallo came back, got the original manuscript. And what was it? Who was the man? Dr. Popoff? What was his name?
Oh, the Gallo's helper.
Yeah, who was it? Durovic?
It was a name, something of that sort. Yes, I've forgotten. Yeah.
Anyhow, here Gallo had scribbled through all of his statements and rewrote them. And indeed, out comes this letter saying, oh, yeah, we filmed this virus. And yet we're then shown what is supposed to be the virus. But then later we find out it's not actually the picture of the virus. It was a construct. And so then later, after this letter came out, and after this was reviewed, a large group of scientists, impeccable credentials, wrote a letter to the editor of Science Magazine saying, please retract Robert Gallo's original articles because they're inaccurate. And they sent this revised, heavily edited piece by Gallo and the original. So we have two different realities. We have one, the original director of the National Cancer Institute's lab under Gallo, and we have Gallo's coming back and scribbling through his notes and changing the entire context, because had the first article been published in Science Magazine, there would have been no defining an HIV virus as unique. There would have been no war on AIDS because there would have been no major new discovery. But with Gallo, who also benefited from the antibody test, now we had this whole epidemic. So the entire edifice of the war on AIDS is based upon one man. And interesting that recently the Nobel Prize in Science went to Luc Montagnier for being the discoverer of the HIV virus. Now, that's the first time that I could find, when I researched the evidence, that one scientist was given the credit, when we were told there were two scientists who co-discovered it together or at the same time. And so there has never been an exception in the world of the Nobel Prize giving two people co-discovered something, giving it all to one person. It just hasn't happened. So what are we to make of this? That what does the Nobel Prize Committee know that we don't? And then we have Luc Montagnier, the discoverer of the HIV virus, stating, well, that he really didn't completely isolate it. Now, he has said that. We have that on tape. And when you play that to one of the truth deniers, those people who support without question the HIV causes AIDS, etc., well, here's the man who discovered it. And he's saying he didn't fully isolate it. He also says that if you have antioxidants, clean water, and a good diet and a strong immune system, you can expel it from your body completely. He also says that if you're healthy, you can come into contact with the virus and never get sick. And yet everyone else, you're telling us, to the activist, that you can get this very easily, that it's infectious, and that everyone is equally susceptible. So we have some major contradictions. And in good science, you have those people brought together to share the best evidence they have, and people who do not have a financial stake or an ego stake or reputation stake come in and evaluate the information and put it to the test. And that's where we are.
I'm still hoping that that's going to happen.
Could you address the issues I just discussed, please?
Yeah, I'm still hoping that eventually the scientists will actually behave as proper scientists and investigate the claims that that the critics have made of the HIV theory. The reality is that neither Gallo nor Luc Montagnier, who received the Nobel Prize, nor any other researcher has defined what they call the HIV genome by obtaining the appropriate genetic material from purified retroviral particles. Gallo, as you say, his claims have been widely criticized because of the way he went about making his claims, and there've been a variety of inquiries, which, as you also say, I'm quite sure that was why it led the Nobel Prize Committee to exclude him from the prize for the discovery of the so-called discovery of HIV. But my quarrel is with all of those, including critics of the theory that HIV is this deadly virus it was purported to be. My quarrel is with the very concept of a virus. As you say, Montagnier has said on camera, we did not purify. They were unable to actually find the virus and isolate it and purify it, and therefore define the HIV entity by obtaining the genetic material from purified particles. There's still no proof of the existence of the genome of a new virus. Therefore, no proof exists for the existence of the... In fact, furthermore, no proof exists for the existence of the whole supposed HIV genome in even one AIDS patient. This is the amazing thing. And when you get people talking about viral load and these things, what you have there is something very similar to the problem with the HIV test. The HIV test, so-called, does detect raised levels of anti-cell antibodies. It does detect raised levels of antibodies. Those antibodies are not to a deadly new virus, but they are antibodies of a certain type that are common in people with the range of conditions that you've mentioned. That's the key. And similarly, tiny segments of the purported HIV genome can be detected through amplification measures, but they're often wrongly taken as confirmation of an HIV diagnosis. That's because they've never been proved to belong to HIV, but they can be seen to be present in people with these conditions of raised levels of the antibodies which cause them to test HIV positive as a result of their being subject to this wide range of conditions which produce those raised levels of antibodies. So there is a link between testing positive and risk of illness, but it might be a temporary one. In some instances, it may mean that you have an autoimmune condition that will carry you off. It will cause your immune system to go into failure. In other instances, it might be something completely temporary. As you've said, for example, recent exposure to flu vaccine, for example, can cause you to test HIV positive. But the amazing thing is that none of these HIV diagnoses is valid. There is no HIV. It's abnormally stimulated cells, that's what produces newly generated gene products that may be at higher levels and so-called viral load, but it's abnormally stimulated cells, not the presence of a deadly virus that causes those so-called viral load measures. This is another of the huge mistakes, but once you get it, it kind of answers all of the apparent paradoxes that we've seen over these years. But there are, even among the people who've been the scientists who've been questioning the HIV theory in general, this actual focus on the non-existence of HIV is almost too much for them to cope with, because it just seems so impossible that the world's doctors and scientists could work for 30 years and spend several hundred billion dollars, mostly US taxpayers' dollars, on diagnosis and treatment of a non-existent virus. It seems impossible, but I've reached the position that I really believe that's what's happened, and it's ultimately a simple mistake, and it's not wickedness. It was a simple mistake that got in there at the outset in that febrile mood and atmosphere when AIDS was first appearing, and then the scientific community failed to correct its mistake. It's really amazing.
All right, let's see if we can deconstruct this so it makes sense, because there's a lot of people listening right now are saying, well, that doesn't make any sense, because the people at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which really oversees the war on AIDS in the United States, as well as National Institutes of Health, they say there are hundreds of thousands of published papers defining HIV and how it manifests in the body and how it kills T cells and how it weakens the immune system and how some people can live longer and other people shorter. So we have all these papers and all this science and all these hundreds of billions, over $800 billion to date, more than on cancer and heart disease combined, spent on AIDS. So clearly the science is not what's an issue. It's you have a faulty perception. Address their statement that they have all of science on their side, all these publications on their side, and you're making a hypothesis. Deconstruct that argument, please.
I can't challenge them. They're right. More than 350,000 papers, 350,000 at the latest count that I heard of, have been published predicated on the virus theory. They're right about that. But to overturn such a massive belief system would be painful. But I'm arguing that perpetuation of the virus theory is causing much unnecessary suffering, as well as an enormous misdirection of human and financial resources, especially in Africa. I would like people to actually engage with these scientists in Perth. How many of your listeners know of the work of the Perth Group of Scientists? How many of them have studied those papers? I've been examining them for years. Those scientists have been working on this for 30 years. But the censorship and the blanket statements that 350,000 papers predicated on the virus theory can't all be wrong, that kind of you can't respond to that other than to say, well, you're right that those papers exist and that you've got the huge weight of scientific and medical opinion is on your side. But sometimes even huge and respectable professions like science and medicine do get it wrong. I'm just asking that there should be the examination and response to the case that is being made by that Perth group of scientists. You see, I it just saddens me so much that when someone like Celia Farber or myself or others, there was a come out with things that questioned the HIV theory, they're stamped on as denialists instead of people taking the trouble to address the issues. The issues are science. I can't summarize the results of 30 years of work by the Perth group of scientists in a kind of half an hour. But I can tell you that whenever I've tried to raise these things, there hasn't been a reasoned response from the scientific establishment. Very recently, there was a German filmmaker called Anne Sonno who produced a documentary called I Won't Go Quietly. Very interesting documentary in which she included interviews with a number of people who've had an HIV diagnosis, who described the agony that it had caused them, and who described why they had finally decided that it was mistaken. They'd gone into these issues, and they had come to the conclusion that whatever the meaning, it wasn't that they were infected with a deadly virus. And when Anne came to London to try to show this movie, which is a very, very carefully and honestly made movie, she'd lined it up to be shown at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And just 2 hours before it was due to be shown, the school announced that there'd been objections and it was not to be shown. It's that kind of pervasive censorship, an inability and unwillingness to engage with those scientists who have these different viewpoints, which I'm saying, how can you possibly be sure that the 350,000 papers predicated on the virus theory are right when the scientific establishment and others who have the huge resources, those hundreds of billions of dollars, but when they won't engage with this, when they just say, oh, they're denialists, we're wasting our time. You there's no answer to that except please, please listen. There may be a valid viewpoint here.
Neville, we're at the end of this hour. I'm going to ask you to stay over for another hour or as much of that as we can because I want to examine now the statements that have been made throughout the last 30 years, that it's infectious, it's sexually transmitted, that the antiretrovirals are the treatment of choice, and that AZT saved a lot of lives. And the media has been objective in the reporting, and the scientific community has been honest in its efforts. And who knew about the Perth Group? The question is, does anyone want to know the truth about the Perth Group? And what is the latest statements from the Perth Group? I've filmed them twice. I know what they have to say. And I have filmed many people, some who believe that the HIV virus was indeed established, but it did not have the power to do everything we are told it did, and others who believe that let's re-examine because the evidence is not crystal clear that it has been created, and others who say it was never isolated completely, and therefore an entire scientific misguided approach to this major condition has existed. I'm Gary Knoll, and from London, Neville Hodgkinson, my guest, an outstanding award-winning British journalist who was the medical and scientific correspondent for the London Sunday Times, arguably the most important scientific medical journalist in the world, is my guest. And his reputation, his sense of ethics, his sense of fairness was look for the truth, and he acknowledged in this hour that he was a true believer in the original concept until he did his own independent homework and found that there were myths, and then there was not a positive response when he tried to share his point of view. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Okay, start the intro music again.
Sorry, what was that, Gary?
Start the intro music again, and you've got to put out music on the end there. You were not paying attention.
It's just me here right now, and I'm doing the live shows.
Okay. All right, just give me the intro music, please, and then we'll get back into the show.
Just intro music.
Is he starting another guest?
No, we're doing a second hour.
So you want to, all right, we'll put the music on. It's best that we don't, but all right, here it goes.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, an in-depth look at the pain, the profit, and the politics of AIDS. 30 years on. From London, in part two of our discussion, Neville Hodgkinson, the British journalist who started reporting on the AIDS epidemic in the mid-1980s, and who has been a medical and scientific correspondent for the London Sunday Times, as well as the Sunday Express and the Daily Mail. He has written numerous articles on HIV and AIDS. He has reported from his original stories in Africa, Australia, and Europe. And he has written books on the topic, and he is here with us now to continue a discussion that simply could not be all revealed within 1 hour. Nice to have you with us, Neville.
Hello, Gary. It's good to be with you.
Neville, I want to share some of my own original early investigations into this phenomenon and then ask you to take any one or several of my points and see how they resonate with your own independent research, all right?
Okay.
I began working with Dr. Stephen Chiesa, a gay physician in New York City, a very popular physician, who was treating people with an aqueous vitamin A. Normally, there is very few people treated with this, and he was helping people with syphilis. And he called me in the mid-1970s, about 1973, 11 years before AIDS became identified as this major epidemic, and he was seeing some bowel diseases in men who were living what he called the fast-track lifestyle. I'd never heard of that before. And he said, I know that you're working with people with immune dysfunctional conditions. Could you help them? And so he sent over some people, and after talking with them, all of the people who sent me were gay men by lifestyle, which didn't matter to me because I've always been a supporter of gay rights and a gay lifestyle. If a person chooses that and or if it's what they're living through, that's their business. And but I didn't know of the dynamic that was called the fast life lifestyle, fast track. And what I found after dozens of interviews was that most of the men had few things in common. First, they had multiple sexually transmitted diseases, including hepatitis. They had a lot of problems with their blood because many of the men had unprotected anal intercourse, and the lining of the rectum is not the same as a vagina. As a result, they were tears in it, and semen was being taken along with other debris and bacteria into the bloodstream through the rectum, and they were having liver problems, kidney problems, bloodborne problems, sexually transmitted diseases. And then I found something interesting is the lack of sleep. So sleep deprivation, which in and of itself is a major immunosuppressant, and many of them smoked, had taken drugs because there was gay liberation, there was sexual revolution in the heterosexual community as well, and it was vibrant within the gay community, and they were partying hard. And so what I did was I put them on a nutritional program, rebuilt the intestines as best as possible, and gave them the healthy bacteria, the probiotics, generally five times a day, and asked them to stay away from recreational drugs, smoking, drinking, and not sex in and of itself, because I never saw that, you know, protected sex was unhealthy, but everything else that frequently went with that whole disco scene and the partying scene could be unhealthy. In any case, the people got their health back. And the more they got healthy, the more people were sent to me by Dr. Kaiser. And this went on for a decade. And then came AIDS, and then we were told that it had nothing to do with lifestyle. It had to do with sex and a virus. And then we were told it wasn't gay men who were going to be dying of this. It was anybody, that everybody was equally susceptible. I even once asked, what if you were a nun, celibate, at a convent in Massachusetts? It didn't matter. And so everybody was susceptible. But over the years, I found that the people who were defined as AIDS cases were intravenous drug users, generally heterosexual, fast-track gays, who represented about 2% of the gay population. The average gay person had no HIV infection or tested positive, and for all intents and purposes, just living a normal, healthy life, and hemophiliacs. And when I was in a rather unique position, because at the time I was also a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, where I'd be a scientist for over 30 years, my work was in nutrition science, but also anti-aging science. And there were a lot of other scientists who were doing more traditional work on chemotherapy agents and anti-pain medication, etc. And across the street, we had Trafalgar Hospital. And there was a methadone treatment, and the court would give you a choice. You either take drug treatment or you go to jail. So all these young people were showing up there taking the treatment instead of going to jail. And the doctor, who was the head of the Trafalgar Hospital, said, "We're not having much success, but I hear that some of the people you've worked with, including a nephew of this person who I'd worked with, was able to give up the drugs and live a healthy life and didn't go back. Could you see what you could do?" So over a period of time, I began to help these people, giving holistic protocols. And I came up with ways using high doses of certain intravenous vitamins, like vitamin C, and other nutrients to supplement the cravings they had for either heroin, smack, or cocaine, whatever they were on, and wean them off, including off methadone. But in the process, I also had a chance, a perfect opportunity to have a large group of people, thousands over a period of years, who I was able to work with one-on-one and also saw their blood chemistries. And their blood chemistries were a sewer, because back then, most of these people were sharing needles. And so these would be the very same people that would test positive for HIV because they had multiple viruses coming into their body, including hepatitis and herpes 6 and bacteria and Epstein-Barr virus. They were loaded. And so when we would clean them up, which generally took anywhere from a year to a year and a half, and rebalance their biochemistry and put them on a clean, healthy, plant-based diet and give them lots of fresh organic juices and homeopathics and zeolites and de-stressing and yoga and meditation and psychotherapy to deal with their underlying family and personal issues, they didn't go back, the vast majority. But more importantly, they would later test that they were healthy. Their blood chemistry was healthy. And so then when I started hearing that, oh yeah, all these intravenous drug users, these are heterosexuals, but they've got AIDS. And I thought, well, let's do a study here. So I did a series of studies, and I found out that a lot of things will test you positive without having the HIV virus. And that's where I started being concerned. Then within the gay community, I had a lot of gays listening to my radio show. I was invited to the Gay Vegetarian Society that I didn't even know existed, and I gave a speech there, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people, and I asked them, how many of you here are healthy, who live a healthy diet? All the hands went up. How many juice and take vitamin C and be complex? Hands went up. Exercise. And how many have a lot of sex? All the hands went up. How many have tested positive for HIV? Only two hands. And I said, have you been tested? Everyone said yes. So you've all been tested, but only a tiny amount, infinitesimal amount. Two people out of this whole room, if you're being honest, have tested positive. So then I spoke with the two people in private, and I said, did you ever do drugs? Yeah, I did drugs. Did you? And I went through all, and they did the same thing as the unhealthy heterosexuals had. And so that convinced me that being gay did not make a person susceptible to AIDS or the AIDS virus at the time, which I believe existed. And so, but getting them healthy was the key. So I worked with over 1,200 gay men and about 30 women who had full-blown AIDS diagnosis, generally pneumocystis or Kaposi sarcoma, and but thrush and other conditions as well, and over a period of about a year and a half to 2 years, was able to get them healthy, but in 12 out of 12 cases that worked on an intensive protocol meant they had to be there 6 days a week for 4 hours because they were getting up to 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day. They completely reversed all diseases and went HIV positive, HIV negative. During this period of time, the tennis star, Arthur Ashe, came by the Tri-State Healing Center. And by the way, 80% of these people never paid a penny. That didn't mean their treatment was free because vitamin C drips and the doctors all had to be paid. I did that. But most were indigent, and I just went ahead and I told them I'll pay for it. So I was working with a large group of people, with medical doctors, working with them on protocols that I had created, and we were reversing their conditions. Arthur Ashe came by and spent a lot of time talking with them over a long period of time until he was convinced that this protocol was working, though he never used it himself, which is unfortunate. And evidently, he spoke with someone, with Tony Brown, who was a very popular African-American journalist, an outstanding journalist, who had one of the most popular shows on PBS in about 420 stations in the United States. And Tony Brown, who I knew of, contacted me and said, I understand you got some people who are reversing AIDS. I said, that is correct. So he sent his team over, and they looked at medical records. So there's a whole verification process, as there should be. And finally, he said, I am convinced, based upon the interviews of the patients, reading their medical records, verifying this to our physician, that these people have reversed AIDS. And this is news. This is important. So he invited them over a period of 4 or 5 years, 8 of them on his program. I was also invited. And these are a matter of historical fact. And we discussed their treatment. All the treatments were successful, complete reversal. And yet no one within the gay community and the AIDS gay community, no one with any of the organizations receiving money from Burroughs Welcome, none of the activists would talk about it. Now, other gay activists did. John Laurinson did. And Charles Ortlieb of the New York Native, who I consider an American hero, in my opinion. He was a phenomenally courageous and great human being. And Nina Ostrom, his leading author, they did dozens of articles on the very thing that you're discussing. So anyhow, so my experience told me that it wasn't infectious, that sex was not how it was transmitted, and I kept, as a journalist who's published over 600 articles and broadcast over 300 original investigative reports, including the first articles ever published in a national magazine, on the politics of cancer, I looked at the politics of cancer and the misguided notion of chemotherapy's efficacy, and the whole community believed that it was efficacious, and it wasn't. The science wasn't there for most of it. In fact, it caused cancer, and many people were dying because of the chemotherapy and radiation, not because of the cancer. But everyone had bought into it. It was too big to change. And so I had already saw this in other areas of medicine. So now I'm thinking, wow, it's happening in science. So I wrote a series of articles. I did a documentary called AIDS, the Real Heroes, where I followed 40 individuals on different therapies who all were making progress, but they all had something in common. They were using positive psychology, cleansing, detoxifying, herbs, and Chinese medicine. They weren't on, a couple were on my protocol, but the rest of them were other people, but they were long-term survivors. At the same time, I'm watching the numbers of those die who were using AZT and were joining the support groups that were sponsored by the AIDS activists, and they were dying in huge numbers. In fact, I'll never forget this. One guy, real tall guy, I think he was 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", he comes in one time and he said, I'm from California, and I heard that there's an AIDS support group here. I said, yeah, come in. You know, say hello to everyone. He said, well, he said, I've been diagnosed with HIV, but I was unhealthy for a period of my life because I was doing drugs and living a very unhealthy lifestyle. But I went holistic, and I've been healthy, but I keep going to the AIDS support group out there. And for the past 5 years, all those people in all of my AIDS support groups are dead, every single one. I said, how many is that? He's probably around 2,000. He said, so I left. And he said, the activists out there were really angry with me. They didn't want me talking about health and nutrition and vitamins and supplements and herbs and homeopathy. They said it's all nonsense and quackery. They wanted drugs. And I said, but everyone taking your drugs dies. Everyone. And they said, well, that's not true. And so he said, well, show me the long-term survivors. And all he got was attitude and politics until they told him not to come around anymore. Hence, he moved to New York to be around his family. Now, when he saw that the people in this support group and healed with Michael Elner, Dr. Michael Elner's support group, were long-term survivors and regaining their health if they changed their lifestyle, if they gave up the drugs, the amyl nitrate, the drinking, the staying up all night, and sleep deprivation, stress from being diagnosed, etc., they improved. So I came to the decision that AIDS is not an infectious disease. It's not principally spread sexually, though you could affect the immune system substantially based upon the type of sex, and that the people getting it had multiple infections. Any one of these is enough to kill you. A massive antibiotic overuse, which depresses the immune system, massive gut flora contamination, and put all together, nutrient deficiencies, and then taking AZT. And I said to him once at a lecture, I said, if this room was filled with Olympic athletes, vegan, never smoked, never drank, never took a drug, if you were on AZT at 1,600 milligrams 4 times a day, you would all be sick or dead within 2 years. So why would you give a person who is sick such an immune-compromising chemotherapy agent that was so toxic it wouldn't be used in the war on cancer, and that's where it was created? And yet it didn't sink in. And then the attacks occurred. You know, oh, you're an AIDS denialist. I said, really? I said, well, I've worked with 1,200 people one-on-one. I've reversed AIDS. I've written a textbook on AIDS with over 4,000 scientific references that was vetted by Professor James Feast at the publisher's insistence to make sure that it was completely accurate. I've written over 29 articles. I wrote the longest article on natural approaches to AIDS, published in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients, showing people how to get well. So I'm not in denial of AIDS as individual medical condition. I'm challenging that your approach of giving them all these drugs is hastening the death of hundreds of thousands of people, and how you're diagnosing AIDS by symptom alone in Africa and frequently just by a low under 200 T-cell count here is false, because I took vegan, healthy marathon runners and I took their blood 3 days before the New York City Marathon. They all had under 200 T-cells. A couple weeks later, after they recovered from their extensive training, their T-cells came back normal. I said, if those people had gone in to get an HIV antibody test, and if any of them had any hepatitis or anything else, and they had low T-cell, they'd be on chemotherapy agents. And that's how bad it was. So that's what got me going in the direction of questioning everything. And then the more people I spoke to, the more questions arose that challenged the prevailing views, including an in-depth interview with Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR, polymerase chain reaction, and that is used in AIDS. And he said that he tried to find out the truth about this virus directly from Gallo, who he knew, and he couldn't find it. And everywhere he went, he kept looking for the paper that would prove the virus had been isolated and it was caused. And I wrote an article based upon the CDC's own information that showed that of 5,000 people who died from AIDS that year, none could be determined to have died from the virus. It was called idiopathic, of unknown origin. So how do you have a person die of AIDS who doesn't have the AIDS virus? That's like saying a man was shot to death with 300 bullets. Well, the coroner couldn't find any bullet wounds or bullets. Well, then he didn't die of gunshot. Well, we have to say he died of gunshot wounds, but there are no bullets. So how do you have 5,000 people in a year die of AIDS, but not HIV? And these contradictions kept coming up. And no matter what the contradictions, the journalists in America were writing more like PR press releases than challenging these. So that is my personal experience, and I'd like for you to address any of these in light of what you, as a journalist, have found for yourself.
Well, Gary, it's the first time that I've really heard the full story of your involvement with this tragic episode in medical and science history. And I'd like to say many congratulations for still being involved after facing what must have been agonizing frustrations at times, as methods of helping people that you knew would work were being disregarded, not only by, in some instances, by doctors and scientists, but also in some instances by the very people that you wanted to help most, because they were caught up in an emotional and political and social pressures that led them to be unable to hear the things that you were saying. I'm so struck by the pressures. You mentioned Charles Ortlieb. He was a great journalist, and the New York Native was outstanding, but they had to shut down because there was a kind of boycott on them by the gay lib leaders at that time, because he was airing these different perspectives about HIV and AIDS, so-called HIV and AIDS. And you were reminding me, too, of Michael Callan, a delightful fellow, gay man, told me his story when he was over in London at one time. He came from the US, and he said how that bathhouse scene, where what you called the fast-track gay lifestyle, he said it was very attractive. It was extraordinary fun with the drugs and the sexual encounters, but it just was biologically very damaging. And as you rightly said, it was a tiny percentage of gay men who were actually the pioneers of that really fast-track lifestyle. And they were doing it in many ways as a reaction against the suppression of homosexuality when, you know, it used to be listed alongside homicide in dictionaries of pathologies, which was completely wrong. And one of the really good things that's happened as a result of the so-called HIV theory of AIDS, it's actually, I think it contributed to the much more understanding and accepting and liberal attitudes towards sexual lifestyles that we have today. I think that's a really good benefit. It was a kind of madness that existed previously when people with those particular ways of choosing to follow their sex lives were subjected to suppression and social sanctions, a kind of madness. And I'm so glad that that's ended. And I think the fact that the HIV story, as you rightly said, it sort of seemed to democratize this new syndrome of AIDS, and therefore reduced the pressure that those pioneers felt that if they accepted that this was a gay plague, as it was characterized in the very early years, along with those homophobic attitudes that led to the feeling, well, we don't need to put money into this, we don't need to pay attention to this because it's a gay plague. And there, it was that kind of attitude that led to this strong reaction against the lifestyle links that you have rightly highlighted, and which many of the researchers and many of the people I've spoken to also highlight as being the key factor in causing AIDS in that small subset of men who were the pioneers of that fast-track lifestyle. Michael Callan was one. I said to him when he was over here, because he had AIDS. He unquestionably had AIDS. And I said, if it's not HIV, what is it? And he said, you try having 3,000 men up your butt by the time you're 26 and not get sick. He was quite frank in telling me that. And he wrote a wonderful book where he listed all the multiple infections that he'd suffered from. It was like a textbook of disease, the range of illnesses that he'd been through, But when he tried to write with another gay man a big article, it was published in the New York Native, and I think the heading was something like, "We know who we are." In other words, we know who among the gay community is really at risk. It's these guys like me who, as a protest against society's suppressive attitudes, broke out with this kind of lifestyle. We are the ones who are at risk. It's not necessarily some deadly new virus that's going to affect everybody. But that wasn't a message that the gay leaders at that time wanted to hear, because it could have led to a regression to those early responses of, it's a gay plague, why should we bother? And the doctors, many of them gay themselves, who were treating especially gay men, were up in arms about this kind of negative attitude and the writing off of it as a gay plague. And hence, that was another of the social pressures to welcome a virus that wouldn't discriminate, a virus that would put everyone at risk. And this was part of the tragic, but almost a kind of, it's a very human circumstance in which the theory came into being in that way. I would like to make one or two other comments on your beautiful description of your experience. Lifestyle, my experience has been that I've seen a number of studies and met individuals where lifestyle change led to the disappearance of both the so-called HIV antibodies, of those raised levels, so they tested positive, they no longer tested positive, and also the disappearance of the illnesses that could have led on to the disease we call AIDS and death. But there have also been a number of people that I've met who had an AIDS diagnosis, an HIV-AIDS diagnosis, who had learned of the importance of lifestyle factors in contributing to both the HIV positivity and the risk of AIDS, and who had made changes, but who went on to lose their lives very tragically. Now, I don't know what the reasons were. Sometimes I think in some of these cases, like Michael Callan, who died he survived something like 15 years with his AIDS diagnosis, but eventually he succumbed. It may be that sometimes the damage has just gone too far to the immune system. It may be that sometimes an autoimmune reaction has got underway and the body's that becomes progressive and eventually carries you off. There's a variety of possible reasons why this is. I think another one is especially in those days when an HIV diagnosis was like a hex, like a witch doctor's curse. You're going to die, mate. You'd better go on these drugs and quick. And that kind of hex and the fear associated with it, it's well known that sort of intense fear and also the social stigma that was associated with this diagnosis at one time could in itself cause immune system decline and dysfunction and possibly lead on to death. Then also there are the drugs, which unquestionably in the early years cost thousands of lives. Things are much better now. I think that the broad-spectrum antibiotic approaches, which is really what these cocktails of drugs do currently, although it's claimed that they're specific to HIV, but actually they're a kind of broad-spectrum approach to dealing with AIDS symptoms, such as when the pneumocystic pneumonia emerges or problems with the fungal infections taking you over. These treatments will help to control those things, and so they're useful these days, but they shouldn't be regarded as something that you have to necessarily take for life, which is the understanding that accompanies the infection with the deadly virus theory. Now, I want to tell you a story about Africa. I mentioned earlier that the newspaper, the Sunday Times, sent me to Africa at one point because I'd written all these stories questioning the HIV theory and supporting that questioning with all sorts of different aspects about, many, many different things. I wrote about 50 articles on this over a two-year period, and the newspaper got right behind it. But Africa remained a mystery because we were told that these millions were infected and dying. One of the places I turned up at was in northern Tanzania, I'd heard that a pilot and his wife, a teacher, they had no children of their own. In midlife, in France, where they came from, they'd decided to retrain in tropical medicine. This was a guy called Philippe Crinan and his wife, Evelyn. And they retrained, and they went to Africa to help AIDS orphans. And they found their way to the province of Bukoba in northern Tanzania, where they were told that this was an epicenter of AIDS in Africa. It was up near the border with Uganda. And to begin with, they heard about the deaths being attributed to HIV, because scientists had been in there with HIV tests, and nearly everybody, so many who had illnesses, would test positive. And so there was a huge amount of fear about it all. And they actually went public in saying that whole football teams in villages were dying, and they bought into this story that there were numerous orphans, there was a danger of kids growing up feral, you know, with that, like wild kids, because of a lack of parents. And this was because they believed the stories that they were told initially, and they went international. This became a big story. It was the first time that some scientists from the West were actually hands-on there in Africa, saying, look, these warnings about Africa being in the grip of this terrible epidemic and well ahead even of the rest of us in the world, these are real, and there is a massive threat here. And these stories appeared in America, across Europe, and they got a lot of money as a result, a lot of money. It poured in. And when I went to see them, I turned up unannounced because I didn't have a phone number or anything. I arrived about 7 o'clock in the morning after a journey across Lake Victoria, one corner of Lake Victoria. And we spent a long day together from about 8 in the morning till midnight. It gradually unfolded. Philippe said, look, I came here to help AIDS orphans, and I've concluded at the end of 5 years of work here that there is no AIDS and no AIDS orphans. And his reasoning was, he'd gradually been led to this understanding, because to begin with, he found that different HIV tests produced greatly different results. You know, some would say 20% of the population, same group tested with another kit might be 40%. These kind of differences were substantial. So that made him wonder initially. Then as that wondering increased, and because there was so much fear in the community about being tested, he persuaded them that he would actually help those who tested HIV positive with substantial resources of nutrition and drugs to deal with the illnesses that they might have, with TB and malaria and other things. And so on the basis of that promise, he had a big cohort. He had 7,000 children in his care at this point when I visited him. And you know, it's amazing. What he revealed to me was that those children who had tested positive and were therefore in his care, but when their illnesses were treated for what they were, rather than with antiviral drugs, when they were treated for the TB that they had or whatever it might be, and when they were given nutritional support, they came from these extremely poor families, when they had that care, their health records, their survival rates were much better than those of the kids who didn't have HIV positivity and therefore didn't have this support. It was really remarkable. And this had led him to this conclusion that the scare about HIV, when scientists first came from the West and told these people there that they were doomed, basically, because so many were testing positive, that scare had led to these misdiagnoses of other incidents, like the football team died probably because of some contaminated drugs, recreational drugs. There was some other explanation for it, which he didn't have at the time, because everything was being re-diagnosed as HIV/AIDS, everything, because of the scare, and also because it brought money. I remember Harvey Bialy, a scientist who investigated AIDS from a questioning point of view in Uganda, telling us at one point that even if you got knocked down by a bus in Uganda at one point when this scare was at its height. It would go down on your death certificate as AIDS-related suicide. It was a bit of a joke, but he was making a point that at that time, everything was being re-diagnosed as HIV/AIDS. It didn't matter what it was. If it could come under that category, partly because of the fear and also because funds would come towards you. So this was the extraordinary story that he told. Now, you would think that his backers, who included the European Community's AIDS Task Force, would be delighted to hear that here was someone saying that actually the situation's not as bad as we thought it was, but if we give nutritional support and treat these people for the illnesses they've actually got, they will do better than the others who seemingly didn't have this purported virus. And but instead, when I reported his findings in the Sunday Times, the European Community's AIDS Task Force sent a representative to Dar es Salaam, the capital of Tanzania, to try to have him thrown out of the country. They cancelled his next promised grant of some thousands of pounds and tried to have him thrown out. Fortunately, I'd met someone from the Home Ministry when I was in Dar es Salaam, and I'd shared with them my genuine concerns about what was going on, and the president of the country stepped in and allowed Partage Tanzania, this charity helping these African kids, to remain. Now, some years later, it was reported at the European Community by a Belgian physician that he'd been out there. He'd been intrigued by this story I'd written, which incidentally brought huge condemnation in the UK from Nature and others. It was one of the things that finally triggered people into trying to stop the Sunday Times altogether from issuing these reports. This physician went out to investigate how things were, and he found that this was several years on, and he found that in the area covered by Partage Tanzania, a substantial area, the death rates among children were still well below those in neighbouring areas who were accepting the HIV/AIDS story and who were treating some of these illnesses on the with antiviral drugs and so forth. In other words, this area, which was now a no-AIDS zone because Philip Crinan refused to subscribe to that concept any longer, was they, when they were working on the basis of what the kids actually had and was there in front of them, rather than these purported test results from unvalidated diagnostic kits, the health outcomes were significantly better, and that was reported to the European Community. But, you know, like some of your listeners, I think, had been indicating, it's so hard to take these things on board when you've got, you know, 350,000 papers predicated on this belief system of HIV. It's really extraordinary. One other thing to come up. You mentioned about the healthier lifestyles. Absolutely, absolutely right. Even though, as I say, some do die, even when they have made substantial improvements in their lifestyle. But one of the things that is very clearly of value is safe sex. This is because, as you mentioned earlier, the back passage can become vulnerable. It can allow semen into the bloodstream, and that in itself has a damaging effect on the immune system, and other microbes can get in that way too. So safe sex, which was one of the things that actually Michael Callan and his pioneers were saying it makes absolute sense, and they were drawing attention to that before it became a widespread slogan within the anti-HIV workers. That really does make sense. And but one of the advantages of the theory that you could have transmission of this virus through semen was that it led to greater acceptance of safe sex practices. So I'd like to make it clear that I think that that is absolutely vital.
Let us now take a look at, if you were to present to a group of scientists, all the scientists, the several million physicians and scientists working in the field of AIDS for the last 30 years, a synopsis of why they are misguided, misdirected, working within the wrong paradigm, as vaccine scientists have. It's a completely failed concept, and yet it continues to be funded and mandated. What would you say to these people if you had an opportunity to say, unchallenged for a moment, so you get your words out, here's what I'd like to tell you, that as a journalist, as a medical and scientific journalist who knows a great deal about science and knows what is right and wrong, here's what my research has shown me. Please tell us now what you would say to them.
Okay, I would try to summarize it like this, which is that the HIV-AIDS theory arose through a misinterpretation of biochemical signals of cell disorder in AIDS victims. There is cell disorder in people who test positive. It may be temporary, arising, as I mentioned, for example, you've just had some flu jabs. It may be something more lasting. There is biochemical disorder. There is cell disorder producing abnormal biochemical signals. The HIV test detects those signals. And that relationship with risk of ill health was mistakenly taken to indicate the presence of a virus. That's not the reality. HIV, as such, is a mental construct whose material existence remains unproven. I'm really convinced of that. And I've studied so closely. I've only arrived at that over many years, having been a great HIV believer myself for some years and reporting all the claims based on those early predictions of us all being at risk, gradually seeing the whole construct fall apart, and yet others not being able to see that those early predictions were not just wrong because they were over-predicting predictions, but they were wrong because of a root problem in the science. And I would also say that the mistakes that gave rise to the theory, because I really like to emphasize this because it helped people to understand, the mistakes that gave rise to the theory came about in a feverish atmosphere of fear and anxiety when AIDS first struck. There was a rush to find a viral explanation for the new syndrome, and then a global alert sounded over HIV, made it almost impossible for contrary views to be heard. That's the tragedy. That's where the science went wrong. That contrary views were really suppressed. People, and right to today, you have these people saying these denialist accusations against good scientists who've worked for decades, unfunded largely, you know, to try to draw attention to these problems, whereas billions, as you've rightly said, have gone to the mainstream people. It's such a tragedy that we've listened to these voices that have suppressed and abused the scientists who tried to say, hang on, take a look, this may not be right. The theory also grew in strength because of several benefits that arose from it. And that included the drive, the impetus it gave to safer sex. It also brought improved drug treatments for people with severe immune deficiency after that initial disaster of AZT that cost thousands of lives. It brought sympathy towards the homosexual community and much greater acceptance of gay and lesbian relationships, which is great. And it brought a huge financial boost for biomedical research. Hundreds of billions of dollars, as you said, have flowed into research and treatment. So it's, you know, to overturn such a massive belief system is going to be hard. But my big concern is that perpetuation of the virus theory is causing so much unnecessary suffering. There's an enormous misdirection of human and financial resources, especially affecting Africa. And mistaken ideas about the causes of AIDS mean that the true causes are not being addressed. And that's a tragedy too. And millions are being burdened globally with a false diagnosis of HIV infection. It's a false diagnosis. There is no HIV has been demonstrated to exist. And many are being persuaded to take powerful drugs, especially I would say that this is less true in Europe now, but because there's much greater caution about making an AIDS diagnosis. But in Africa, whereas, as you rightly said, you can get a diagnosis even on the basis of a few symptoms of common illnesses in Africa, such as persistent cough and weight loss, many are being persuaded to take drugs that, in the absence of genuine immune deficiency, will do them more harm than good. And you've even got healthy Americans now being urged to take expensive anti-HIV drugs, supposedly to prevent infection. It's like, to me now, it's like a madness that's gone to an extreme, and the time for a really deep review of the science is long overdue.
Let's take a look at four issues in order, and in this case, because we only have about 12 minutes left, shorter answers. There's a group in Perth, Australia. These are highly respected, credentialed, and peer-reviewed published scientists who claim that they could not find evidence of HIV's complete isolation. Could you tell us their latest research and what they have found?
I would like you not to use the expression complete isolation. There was isolation was a term that was quite commonly used, they found, in the early days, but it wasn't isolation at all. It was called isolation, and what it was an enzyme, which is a substance produced that acts as a catalyst for a specific biochemical reaction, an enzyme called reverse transcriptase. And its activity in lab cultures became misinterpreted by the pioneers of the HIV theory as evidence for the presence of a new virus. The Perth group are very clear about this, how this happened. Many of those early papers claimed HIV isolation. They used that term on the basis of detecting reverse transcriptase activity, nothing to do with purifying and characterizing a new virus. And a belief also developed that information, that, you know, after the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, there was a belief became common that information held within DNA is the unalterable basis of our physical being. And it was understood that, well, that the transfer of information from the DNA to RNA, and was that process was thought to be one way only. And then it was found that it could happen in the reverse direction from RNA into DNA, and the enzyme that did that, reverse transcriptase, was associated with the construction of a theory that retroviruses are the ones that cause that. But actually now it's known that reverse transcriptase is not a unique property of retroviruses that HIV was supposed to be. And so measurement of reverse transcriptase activity in those early cultures, which was the basis for the papers claiming isolation, transmission, etc., was a big mistake. A big mistake. That's one of the things that the Perth group have made very plain. But secondly, the assumption that the reverse transcriptase activity in cell cultures meant the presence of a retrovirus, that led to a second huge error, which was bypassing a vital step in virus identification, which is to separate virus particles from cellular material. This step is known as purification, and as you said earlier, Bob Gallo never did it, and Luc Montagnier never did it. They never purified the virus, and without purifying the virus, they repeatedly and regularly tried to purify virus from their cultures, but they couldn't. And that's absolutely plain to anyone who approaches this science with an open mind and with some knowledge of molecular biology. But of course, one of the problems with all of this is that the vast majority of scientists and doctors don't have that knowledge that would allow them to go right down to the root of where these mistakes were made, even though the mistakes were quite simple. So that was the second huge mistake that was made. And then a third one was that when you saw antibody reactivity in cultures where you'd seen this reverse transcriptase activity, that meant the presence of a new virus. Well, we've already discussed that the test has never been validated by showing that the proteins it uses are related to a new virus, because no new virus particles have been purified and analyzed. That's the fact. There is no valid HIV test because HIV has never been purified. And as you also rightly said, subsequent research has repeatedly shown us that many different conditions cause raised levels of the antibodies attributed to HIV, and they put you at risk of being labeled HIV positive when in fact there's no such virus present. I think you said there's something like 90 such conditions now. I know that when I last looked at this some time back, it was more than 60. And they include TB, which is immensely widespread among impoverished people. I'm quite sure it's the cause of millions of misdiagnosed AIDS cases in Africa.
What is the latest research from the Perth group?
They don't do hands-on research themselves. They have done 30 years of work drawing on and studying all the different papers that on the different issues which they see as having led to this false construct of HIV, and they've been trying to deconstruct that with reason and with correspondence and with the demonstration of where the conventional thinking falls down. But they've had an uphill struggle to get anything published, even though they've been working on this for 30 years and are so diligent, and it's a group of about four or five of them. They're experts in their fields, but they're isolated there in Perth, and they've been unable to get published. And it's that right. Tragedy that I think is
then let's look at a few other. We only have 5 minutes. Tell us about how sensitive the mainstream medical and news media is to political and economic pressures versus looking for the truth when it comes to the subject of AIDS.
You know, I've found in my years of covering this issue, to begin with, I was very frustrated because, you know, I found that I couldn't understand why, when I wrote my book, for example, AIDS, the Failure of Contemporary Science, I spent a year pulling together the evidence, much of which was available at that time. There's a little bit more that I've shared with you now, but much of it was available at that time. The subtitle of the book was How a Virus That Never Was Deceived the World. And I thought that when that book came out, that within a few months, that would be the end of this tragic era. But it was kind of a few fringe publications reviewed it favorably, but it was totally ignored by the mainstream. And I've seen that happen again and again. And so I've had to come to terms with the fact that even scientists at the top of their fields have found themselves ridiculed and defunded and unable to publish when they question the virus theory. To begin with, it made me feel angry because I thought that it was money and prestige and so forth. And of course, those are factors. But what I've gradually learned over the years, in my view, the people who continue to persist with promoting the virus theory believe in what they're doing. It's very, very difficult for them to step back and acknowledge that decades of their own work could have been based on faulty science. I actually feel, you know, I feel a lot of sympathy. And I, as I mentioned, many of my medical and science journalist colleagues, they bought into this story, they reported it for years, as I did, and then it's very hard to step back and acknowledge maybe I was really wrong, or maybe I misled our readers with those reports. It's difficult to do that. And it's even more difficult for people in health professions who enter these professions because they want to serve people, And to face the possibility that they could have made such mistakes is a tragic and difficult thing to do.
Neville, we only have time for one more question. And here it is. When you look at everything going on in the field and you see that now we have an industry too big to stop, there's just too much money, too many reputations, massive amounts of lawsuits, isn't it time that journalists go back and look at all of the indicators, looking at the fact that it was not a disease that was infectious? And also, why didn't they look at the Concord study and all the studies that looked at the treatment to show that the treatment was actually increasing the death rate? And no one talks about that today. Well, here's a simple situation. If the major AIDS organizations and the major AIDS activists were not just encouraging, but demanding that there be more money for more drugs, taking more drugs, fast-tracking drugs, not looking at lifestyle, not looking at healthy immune systems, but rather looking at one approach, a monotheistic approach, and then we have the study showing, yeah, these trials occurred, and they showed more and more people died by the hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths, shouldn't there be an acknowledgement that even well-intentioned people, let's not suggest for a moment that it was money or power or anything else, just well-intentioned, but they were wrong. Just like whatever the ultimate motives of George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and all the other people, the neocons, the war in Iraq was wrong. Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction. The attack on Libya and Gaddafi was wrong. Much of what we've done has been wrong with enormously devastating consequences, and yet the people who controlled the system never apologized. And the people who controlled the AIDS paradigm have never apologized. The activists refused to apologize. Just finally, touch upon how many studies have shown that the drugs that they were using for a long time were actually increasing the death of people?
Well, it's certainly true that what they called the gold standard of treatment in the early days, AZT, that's now widely understood to have killed more patients than it helped, and that's putting it kindly. There's been minimal evidence of help beyond a broad temporary antimicrobial effect. The biggest trial of the drug was an Anglo-French trial. It found 25 more deaths among those treated early than in those for whom treatment was deferred. And the difference would almost certainly have been larger if they'd had a different study. They were so believing in that drug that they considered it unethical to withhold it from people. It was just amazing how single-minded the profession was in pursuing AZT as the treatment for AIDS. And anything else was pushed aside. But, you know, your broad question, you've answered the question yourself. Science, theoretically, is a self-correcting, beautiful human system for understanding the truth. In my view, on this subject, up to this point, it has failed because it allowed a false construct to come in and take over the world. And at some point, I'm convinced, too, that some good scientists will acknowledge that there's a need to rethink what happened, really study it, really examine it, and bring the truth to light. I'm sure that will happen at some point, but when, I don't know.
Wouldn't it be interesting if I have done many times, if you did, or if you haven't already, just ask those scientists who are 100% clear that the HIV virus is what, by itself, with no other indicating condition, will cause all 30-plus of these conditions we're calling AIDS. Let them actually prove it and see what evidence they would bring forth. That has yet to happen. And science should be open, it should be honest, it should be transparent, and you should be able to replicate it using the same protocols. And that has not been the case with AIDS, and that's why we are continuing our questions. Neville Hutchinson, thank you very much for being on today and sharing your deep insights. We appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, Gary, and I hope that your programs may strike a chord. Maybe the time is ripe now where someone will listen and the pressure will grow for a proper inquiry into this whole story.
That's all that all of the people, the thousands of activists, journalists, and scientists are asking. Have an open forum, not one in which people come to scream, demean, and aggressively attack, but one where you look at the evidence and come to a reasoned decision. That has not happened. Even when I had Luc Montagnier and Robert Gallo on my radio show, when I asked them the first challenging question, they hung up. That's not the way you conduct yourself if you're confident in the science behind you. But that's what's happened. Thank you very much, Neville.
Thanks, Gary.
And Neville Hutchinson is one of the most respected journalists in the world, and at one time, for many years, for several decades, was considered the single most important medical and scientific journalist in the world, because he was the medical and science correspondent for the London Sunday Times. And you heard what he said, and he did not come to these decisions easily. He was pro-HIV causes AIDS. He was pro the paradigm until he did his actual homework, going to Africa, visiting villages, going to Europe, going to other places, meeting with scientists, looking at the evidence, and then finding questions that could not be answered. And that brought him to the place where he is today. And his voice is important.
I could just add, Gary, that I spent a week in the lab of a virologist in Germany at the University of Dortmund who wanted to demonstrate to me where the molecular biology had gone wrong. That was an amazing opportunity, which not many journalists have had. It was a great thing being able to work for a paper like the Sunday Times who'd give me that opportunity.
And in that laboratory, did that person show you the mistakes?
Absolutely. He introduced me to the basic molecular biology techniques, which he so that I could understand how the mistakes had happened.
I see. Well, that's important. And how many journalists have had that opportunity? Thank you, Neville. And I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Gary Nall.